Are you all are you sleepy or are you awake? It's not a good idea to be sleepy now. Yeah, this is anyway, so I hope you had a good lunch. So now we can get into the sutta called the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the root of all things, doesn't mean all things, but anyway, discourse on the root. And sometimes people think that this sutta is very profound, and it is in many ways, but it doesn't mean that it is impossible to understand it. It is possible. The general ideas behind the sutta, actually, I think, are reasonably not that difficult to understand. Everyone is capable to understand it who is here, I'm sure. So don't be too afraid if you kind of say it's really hard, you don't understand it because you think it's too hard, instead of actually being too hard. So don't be too worried about it. The main content of the sutta is about non-self. This is kind of the theme of the sutta. And of course, non-self is the most profound part of the Buddhist teachings. This is what makes Buddhism unique. This is what makes Buddhism into Buddhism, is the idea of non-self. Because almost all other religions, they have an idea either of a self which lasts forever, or a self that is annihilated when you pass away. But the idea of non-self, the Buddhist way, which is the middle way between annihilation and eternalism, you know what that is, that middle way? Dependent origination. Dependent origination is the middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. And that is what is found in the well-known sutta called the Kacchanagotta Sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, which was one of the possible suttas someone requested as well. I don't know who requested this sutta. Someone is really keen on the suttas, I think. They had this list of really kind of profound suttas, which is nice. So this is all about non-self. And the reason, according to the commentary, why this sutta was spoken was because there were some Brahmins in the Sangha. Just then as now, I suppose, they had an idea of self, the idea that there's a permanent self, which often was considered to be equivalent to Brahma. Brahma is like the cosmic principle of a cosmic self, and then the small self of each one of us is kind of part of Brahma. This is kind of the Brahmanical teachings, which was already current at that time in the Upanishads, especially coming ultimately, perhaps, from the Vedas and all these things. So this is the background. So the Buddha trying to explain to these Brahmins, actually, there is no self. So to do that, he really has to kind of drive it home. So this is all about how he kind of drives home this message that there is no self, looking at it from a large, large number of different angles, if you wish. Okay, so that is just a little bit about the background. And as usual, when I do sutta readings, I usually allow people to ask questions at any time. So if you want to ask a question at any time as we go through this piece, please feel free to do so, because then it's kind of fresh in mind. It's easy to ask questions as we go along here. So let's see what happens. Okay, so the Buddha starts. This is how it starts out. So thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was living in Ukkata, in the Subhaga grove at the root of a royal sal tree. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, venerable sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this. And just to point out to you, if you're not used to reading the suttas, are there many here who are not used to reading the suttas? Yeah, okay, one, two, a few, okay. Good, okay, fourth one, okay, that's okay. So this might put you off for life, This might be it. It's a bad place to start. Anyway, we'll see how it goes. The first sutta, exactly, No, you probably be all right. But sometimes, this is the problem, this is the first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and sometimes people open it, throw it out, never have a look at it again. This is unfortunate. So this is the most profound. So the idea when you read the suttas is to read the suttas you enjoy. So you don't like the first one, okay, skip the first one. Second one don't like, okay, skip that one. Third one, until you find one you like. This is how you do it. So he addresses the bhikkhus, and the bhikkhus are the monks. And it's important to understand that when the Buddha addresses the bhikkhus in this way. He actually includes also the bhikkhunis, of course, because they often would be part of the assembly as well, not just the bhikkhus. And sometimes the lay people would also be present in the assembly. Yeah, both, and so everyone would actually be there. But the way that things were done in India at that time, the Buddha would always address the kind of the most senior disciples who were the bhikkhus. But everyone is actually part of this. So no one is really excluded here. That's kind of, I think, an important point. And so this is what he says. Bhikkhus, I shall teach you a discourse on the root of all things. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. So now we come to what is called here the ordinary person. And the ordinary person in the suttas, they call this the puttujana. I hope you enjoy Pali. I'm going to mention a few Pali words as we go along here. So I hope you like that. Otherwise, yeah, good. Okay, Eileen likes it. Okay, good. So puttujana, puttu means many, and jana is people. So it means like the ordinary, the many folk, yeah, the many person. So it's like the ordinary people, basically, kind of the average person in the world, not the people who have profound insight into the teachings. And one of the things that this sutta does, it shows you the difference in insight between different types of people. Starts off with the ordinary person, then it goes on to the noble ones, yeah, the sotapannas, people who have full insight into the teachings. Then it goes on to the arahat, the fully awakened person, and lastly goes on to the Buddha. And it shows the distinction between these people according to the how this sutta is set up in terms of the insight into non-self. Yeah, this is what the sutta is about, if you like, an important part of it. So this is what the Buddha says. Hear, bhikkhus, an untaught, ordinary person who has no regard for the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma, who has no regard for true people and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma. He perceives earth as earth. Okay, so let's just unpack this a little bit and actually explain a little bit what is going on here. The untaught ordinary person in Pali is the asuttava puttujana. Asuttava means one who has not heard, because in those days the way that you were taught was by hearing. Yeah, everything was oral in those days. The suttas were passed down orally from teacher to disciple for about 400 years before they were written down anywhere. So long periods. So to be learned in those days meant to have heard a lot. The more you heard, the more learned you were as a consequence. So untaught ordinary person here is the person who has no particular insight into the teaching, and also who has no learning from the Buddha, who hasn't heard about the sutta before, yeah, or any other suttas for that matter. So this is like the, from a Buddhist point of view, like the a blind person, if you like, spiritually blind from a Buddhist point of view. And he has no regard for the noble ones. The Pali for that one is Aryanang Adasavi. Adasavi literally means someone who does not see. And what you do not see is the noble people. Yeah, the people who have insight into these teachings. And because you don't see the people who have insight, you don't get to hear the true Dhamma. The true Dhamma is the Dhamma of the Aryans, the insight into reality. To be able to hear the true teachings, first of all, especially at that time, you had to actually see the noble ones, because it was just the only way to get access to these teachings. Now we have the suttas, so you can read about these things, but that time you had to see them. Yeah, so... And that is important also to take into account also in the present day. Remember that, to see the noble ones. What is the easiest way to see the noble ones? The easiest way is to read the suttas. Yeah, yeah. When you read the suttas, you are in the presence of the Buddha, in a sense. And this is one of the perceptions I would really recommend you to develop, the idea that when you read the suttas, the Buddha is actually talking to you. Yeah, and when it feels like the Buddha is talking to you, it's like your hair stands on end, yeah? Especially if you have hair. But so, and it's very powerful, because this is not just a theoretical thing that, you know, it sounds nice or whatever. There's actually much more truth to it than you can imagine, because when the Buddha started to teach these teachings 2,500 years ago, He said that I'm rolling the Dhamma Chakra Pavatana, setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. Yeah, that's what he said. And what does that mean? Well, what it means is that is this the wheel, there's a teaching that rolls out into the world. And it rolls on from one generation to the next one. Yeah, from one century to the next one. Going down the line, continuing on and on and on. And after 2,500 years, it is still here. So because the Buddha had that in mind from the very beginning, the Dhamma Chakra Pavattana, the name of his first discourse, he knew that there would be people way down in the future listening to these teachings. He may not have known that we would be here today, yeah, but something similar to that, something very, very close to that. Maybe he would kind of foresee big cities like Singapore in the future, maybe, I don't know. And so because he had that in mind, he would have he addressed his teachings in a way that was independent of culture, independent of time. Yeah, so it applies to all people because basically we are all the same. People don't want to hear that, but basically we are all the same. Yeah, in a deep sense, we are all the same. So you can teach it in such a way that it actually applies to everyone. So in a very real sense, the Buddha is talking to each one of us. Yeah, because he knew that there will be people there in the future. So read it and think about that. This is the Buddha. He's actually talking to me here. Yeah, he formulated in this way so that every one of us can understand. And once you get that, you feel far more in the presence of the Buddha than if it's some kind of ancient teaching that was taught to someone who you've got nothing to do with. Yeah, it kind of draws you in and makes you much more feel that you have a part in this. Remember that when you read the suttas, you are actually Aryanang Adasavi, rather the opposite. You are the seer of the noble ones. You are in the presence of the Buddha himself. But of course, it's not just the Buddha. There are other people in the world today. Maybe not so many, but there are still some people in this world today who are noble ones. People, sometimes you can have, it's hard to know sometimes who it is, but sometimes you have a feeling that some people have the Dhamma kind of present. Yeah, they have a special qualities. You watch them carefully, you see that they have the qualities of the noble ones. And when you do that, then that's kind of encouraging. But it's very hard to be absolutely sure about that. And because it's hard to be absolutely sure, it's always good to come back to the suttas, come back to what the Buddha taught. That gives you like the gold standard for what is real Buddhism. And if anyone says anything that is opposed to the suttas, then it is likely to be false. The untaught person who doesn't see the noble ones and who is unskilled and undisciplined in the Dhamma, literally, who does not understand a kovida. Kovida comes from the root vid. Vid means to understand or to have insight. And undisciplined, vinita. Vinita means like you have trained. Yeah. So literally means someone who does not understand and who is untrained in the Dhamma of the noble ones. Arya Dhamma, the noble, the Dhamma of the noble people. Yeah. Dhamma here means teaching. Yeah? So unlearned, not lacking in understanding, and not trained in the teaching of the noble ones. And what happens? Then it says also who has no regard for true people. It actually says true men, but true people I think is better. And unskilled and undisciplined in their teaching as well. True men here means like superior people. It's just another word for Aryas, for the noble ones. Sapurisa. Is like the good people, if you like, or the superior people, is what that really refers to. In other words, those who have insight into the teaching. This is often, the teachings of the Buddha are often very, lots of synonyms, saying the same thing in many different ways. So the noble ones, the Aryas, Sapurisa, these are all kind of just different ways of saying the same thing. And what does this person do? They perceive earth as earth. Yeah, so you perceive earth as earth. Doesn't sound very profound, does it? Perceive earth as earth. Okay, what does that mean? And there's many different ways that this can be translated because the Pali Pattaving Patavito Sanjanati, perceiving earth as earth. It sounds like you are perceiving earth in the right way. That's what it sounds like, earth as earth. But actually, it doesn't really mean that. Another way of translating this would be because of earth, he perceives earth. Yeah, because there is earth. You perceive earth. Earth here means like the, almost like the solid element, the other element of hardness or solidity in something. Yeah, whatever is kind of has that nature, if you wish. So because there is earth, you perceive earth. Because there is kind of the solidity, you perceive solid things. Yeah, that's really what it kind of refers to. So when there is certain things exist, you have a perception accordingly. That's really what it refers to. But the point here is that even that perception for the ordinary people is already slightly problematic. Yeah, because one of the things, and this is kind of why we, in Buddhism we're always talking about insight and seeing things according to reality, is of course because we don't normally see things according to reality. We have a problem, yeah? And this is what we are bringing into this process of perception and seeing and understanding and thinking or whatever. We bring that problem into this perception, so we give them a meaning that they don't actually have. So when you perceive earth, for example, you may think of it as more permanent than it actually is. You may think it's going to give you happiness. Yeah, this is my table. Yay. So nobody can take my table. Actually, they can. That's what you forget. So the table is impermanent. Yeah, but you think of it as permanent. You think it's going to give you happiness, whatever it is. And you think of it as potentially also as self. And this is what is this sutta really is about. So there is automatically, for an ordinary person, there is a misperception called sanya vipalasa, distortion of perception, is what this is about. I should maybe say now, before I go on, that if this really doesn't make any sense for you, and if you, what is this? What am I doing here? You are please, you are allowed to leave at any time. Yeah, don't feel bad. You don't have to sit here just to be polite or anything like that. Please leave. If you want to go, that's perfectly okay. Yeah. And we will only have compassion on you if you go here. Okay. So you perceive earth. So you, because of earth, you perceive earth. Yeah. So having had that perception, the next one here, it says, you conceive himself as earth, is the next one. Actually, the Pali just says he conceives earth. So what does that mean? And the word for conceive is a Pali verb called manyati, which literally means to think. Yeah, so you think earth. And but the point here is that the manyati in the suttas is a kind of thinking which is distorted. It's like, maybe I've heard the word papancha. Papancha is kind of a word people use a lot, yeah? This is kind of similar to papancha. It is a distortion in the way that you look at things. So manyati is a distorted perception. So I am not sure if I agree with the translation conceive, because conceive doesn't necessarily imply distortion. So when Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is a translator of this, when he was translating the Anguttara Nikaya, I said, well, why don't we translate as misconceive instead? Because misconceive straight away gives the idea that it's a wrong perception. And he said, yes, okay. So in the Anguttara Nikaya, you will see he translates misconceive rather than conceive. That's because of me. Yes, I was very happy with that. So you misconceive earth. Yeah, he conceived himself as earth. This is what he is saying here. So what does that mean? And remember what we are doing here. We're looking at different ways in which which a self can be. You can have views about a self. Yeah, this is a kind of a developed ideas of a self. These are kind of views that we have about the self. Not necessarily, but most of it, that is what it is. So what kind of view can you have about the self? Well, one view is the idea that the body is like earth element. It's kind of solid, so you can identify with the body. And if you identify with the body, you are saying that you are, he conceives himself as earth. You are the body. Which is kind of strange, because most people don't identify 100% with the body. But usually the mind will come along as well. So one alternative understanding of this would be, for example, when you have a nimitta, you do your meditation practice, you get a beautiful nimitta coming up, and those nimittas are still have a rupa, they still have form to them, yes, they're still related to the four great elements, or derived, if you like, from the four great elements, upadaya. And because they are derived from that, it can also mean an identity with like nimittas you get in a meditation practice. And that kind of makes more sense, because then you are moving in more into the mental world, and not only the mental world, but a very beautiful mental world with lots of joy and happiness, etc. So this is one way of understanding this. You identify with the nimittas, or identify with the earth as a perception of the mind. Yeah, this is one way of seeing this, understanding this. An alternative thing, alternative way of conceiving here is that you misconceive yourself as in earth. Pala just says you misconceive in earth. So this is the idea, and it's fairly obvious, the idea that you have a self, like a mind, for example, and your mind is like in the body. That's what it feels like, yeah? It feels like the mind is inside the body, and the body is here. So you are in earth, yeah? So this is the real self, the permanent essence is the kind of the me inside the body. Yeah? So it kind of sort of makes sense. Then he conceived himself as apart from earth. And the idea here is that there are certain things that you are one thing, yeah, and earth is something else. So you are not the earth. So you kind of identify yourself in opposition to earth. For example, you may have a very profound meditation experience of immaterial experience, and then you realize that there's nothing material about you. So the earth is outside, and you are something different from that. So there's like you this is yourself, and the earth is over here. These are just kind of ways of talking about the self, the way of having identity. And then you have the idea that you conceive earth is mine. Yeah. So if there is something solid in the world, it belongs to you. Myself may be one thing, but any things that are mine, like these glasses, I think they are mine. Yeah. If you take them, I will not be happy. So this is kind of earth element. Yeah. So this is my earth element. So this is another way in which you identify a self. You identify because it owns stuff. The self almost always has something it owns, because that is what the self does. It starts off owning by owning certain attributes and properties. Yeah, if you have a self, it must have certain properties. It might be immaterial, it might be the mind, your perception, your consciousness, but it will have certain properties. And then that tends to expand out to ownership of things as well. This is kind of one of the nature of the sense of self. It owns stuff. So you know that it's there on account of its ownership, on account of owning. So these are the four ways mentioned here. They are very similar to four ways talked about elsewhere. Elsewhere they talk about Sakkaya Ditti. Sakkaya Ditti is the personality view, or identity, personal identity view. The idea that there is some part of you which is identical over time. Yeah, that's what it feels like. Yeah, you are there, and maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever, you were also there, and you have a feeling that you are the same person. Is that how you feel? Yeah, same person going across, or do you feel different person? Same, yeah, so the same, but also a little bit different at the same time, yeah? When you look at yourself in the mirror, you're like, okay, also different as well. Yeah, so it's different and same at the same time. But there certainly is not a feeling that there's something going through, which is the me, which passes through all the way, yeah? And this is, so this is what we are talking about. This is what identity view is about, Sakkaya Ditti. And according to identity view, there's four ways we can have identity view, and it's very similar to what we're seeing here. Four ways that you identify with a certain thing, like you identify with earth, I am earth, you are in earth is in you, or earth is mine. Very similar to this, the only difference is that here you have apart from earth, rather than earth being in you. That's the only difference. So these are just different schemes of thinking about self. And this here may be perhaps a scheme that was used by the Brahmins, that's why he has talked about it in this way here. But the Sakkaya Ditti scheme, which you can find in suttas like the, I think it's in the Shula Vedala Sutta, Majjhima 44 perhaps, somewhere like that. Or also, yeah, I think that's where you find that particular scheme. And I think the most important thing with the Buddha, remember, is not necessarily to be all-inclusive, that he actually has a watertight system whereby everything is mentioned, yeah, all the various ways you can have the self is mentioned. That's not really the main purpose of the Buddha when he teaches the Dhamma. The main purpose of the Buddha is to be pragmatic, is to ask himself, where do people normally see a sense of self? Yeah, and then he answers that particular question regarding to where people see themselves. So if people see themselves as in the body, then he will answer that particular question. He will criticize that and say, actually, there is no self there in the body in that particular way. So Buddha tends to be pragmatic. He's not presenting a philosophical system where all the loopholes are kind of closed in or closed up. Why not? Well, because often philosophy, there's no end to that. There's always more. There's always things to be discussed. So he's more pragmatic, and this is a pragmatic system of inquiring into the sense of self. So this may all sound very strange, but the idea here is just ways of looking at, talking about this kind of amorphous idea of self that this is about. So then, because of all of this misconceiving about earth, then he delights in earth. And this is where craving starts to come up. Delight, nandi, is sometimes used as a word for craving. Yeah. So if you see yourself in relation to earth, yeah, then you... It's actually quite interesting, isn't it? He conceives himself as apart from earth, and then you delight in earth. I wonder how that happens. It didn't occur to me until just now. Okay, anyway, we'll leave that aside. You delight in earth. Why do you delight in it? Well, because it is you. It's either you or it's yours. Yeah. So if you are, for example, if you you have that sense of self, you delight in it. Yeah. You are kind of happy. Tend to have a sense of craving and attachment to yourself. If someone says they're going to kill you, what do you say? No, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Why is that? Because you're holding on to yourself. That's the reason. So you delight in yourself. You delight in existing, in living, etc. So once a self has been established, you delight in that. In the same way, if something is yours, yeah, you delight in that too. You don't want people to come and steal or destroy what is yours. So again, you delight in these things because you have craving and attachment to these things. So if someone says that I'm going to cut off a piece of your body, again, you're not too happy with that because you delight. You'd rather have all the pieces of your body. And this is why that sutta. This is why that sutta is so powerful. The sutta with the two-handled saw, the Kakkachupama Sutta, the simile of the saw, where the Buddha says, you know the simile of the saw. Similar saw where the Buddha says that even if two bandits come with a two-handled saw and they saw you limb from limb, yeah, cutting you apart, still you should only have metta towards those people. That's a very powerful sutta, isn't it? And you can now see how it works. It only works if you have some insight into non-self. You take your identity beyond the body, then you can kind of deal with these kind of issues. So otherwise you will be trapped by these things. Now, I was just thinking here about conceiving apart from earth. For that reason, you delight in it. There's another way of understanding misconceiving yourself as apart from the earth, and that is to misconceive yourself as coming from earth. Yeah, because of earth, being based on earth. This is called the ablative case in Pali grammar, and it has kind of different meanings. So you are somehow related to earth because you come from that. You are derived from that. And this becomes more easy to see later on when we come down to other of these categories. And then, of course, because you are derived from something, then it kind of makes more sense why you might delight in that. Let's not worry too much about that. Otherwise, we probably go too far astray here. Why is that? And he says, because he has not fully understood, I say. And full understanding in Pali is called parinyati. Anyway, something like that. Past participle parinyata. So he has not fully understood. Full understanding here means full insight. Yeah, this is what the Buddhist is always about. Insight, understanding and insight being the same thing. Once you have the insight, you don't see yourself in relation to earth like this anymore. Suddenly earth is just earth. And it's not the problem anymore as it is if you haven't got that insight. Yeah, so this is kind of the thing about the people who have real insight. They have a very different relationship to things. They don't really have any ownership anymore. One of the things you see here is that you relate to things in terms of ownership. So someone who is an arahant doesn't really have any ownership anymore. Yeah, you don't feel like you own things. You probably still have a robe, but you don't have that same possessiveness towards it as you had before. And you will perhaps have seen in the suttas, the Buddha says that about the qualities of the arahant. One of the qualities, they cannot live in a house like before and store up things. Why is that? Well, precisely because you have nothing that is yours. You can't really store things because you don't regard things as yours anymore. So everything is just kind of transient. You're ready to give it up at any time. And this, of course, is why the arahant doesn't suffer so much, because they don't have anything which they consider yours, including the body. And if someone comes and saws you apart limb by limb, you say, oh yeah, whatever, you know, keep on sawing, you know. Wouldn't recommend it because you're making bad karma. But anyway, you know, if that's what you want to do, please go ahead. That's kind of the arahant. I'm not sure if they would say that, but I'm just kind of making up some stuff as I go along. Okay, so that is the basic idea of this sutta, how we relate to a large number of different things. We have just seen the earth now. We're going to have a look at a large number of other things. This is the basic framework, and all the other things after this are based on the same kind of idea. So this is kind of the, if you get what I'm talking about now, then the rest is not so hard to get also. Everyone happy with that? Anyone not happy with that? Okay, good. You're very polite, so that's good. So, yes, please. I think perceptions are, it's hard to see how any perception can ever be absolutely correct, because you are, the vipalasa, the distortions of mind, are always there, yeah, underlying things. So there will always be some degree of distortion. But of course, the distortion gets worse. The more you think about, the more you kind of use your distorted ideas to think about it, the worse it gets, and the more kind of you appropriate it, the more powerful your sense of identity becomes, etc. So initially it's very weak, but it's already there, kind of in embryo, as an embryo in a very small way, and it expands later on. That's how the commentary explains it, that it is there from the beginning. I cannot really see. I discussed it with Ajahn Brahm once, whether there is an initial point where it actually, you know, see it really. But he agreed with that position, that it cannot really be an initial point where you see it as it actually is. It's always distorted from the very beginning, to some extent. Yeah. Okay. So then let's have a look at the next one, sir. He perceives because of water, he perceives water. Having perceived water because there is water, he misconceives himself as water. That's a bit strange, isn't it? Misconceive yourself as water, okay. He misconceives himself as in water. He misconceives himself as apart from water, or perhaps as derived from water. He misconceives water to be mine. He delights in water. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So we are here on the way to seeing the four great elements in Pali. So water is obviously a large part of human beings is water. What is it, 70% or something? So a lot of water in these bodies. So obviously we identify with water also, by its very nature, but just by kind of just because of these bodies, basically. But the idea here is very similar to the previous one, I don't think there's very much to add, except that water also can have a very subtle thing. You can like meditate on water, like the water kasina is one of those meditation objects, and that can become like a nimitta in your mind. So it can also, even this water thing can actually be very subtle, can be a very subtle idea of what you identify with it in as a mental object rather than just the physical property outside. Conceive yourself as in water. So I guess maybe that would be that you have a the mind is you, yeah, and the body is like, you see it as water, huh? So you are in like the water by being in the body, same as before. Huh? so the same idea goes here again. Huh? He perceives fire because of fire. Having perceived fire because of fire, he misconceives himself as fire. He misconceives himself in fire. He misconceives himself apart from fire. He misconceives fire to be mine. He delights in fire. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So again, fire, one of the great elements. Yeah, it's like usually considered like the heat element in the body, which is the fire. So again, you are identifying with the body, the physical aspects of the body in a certain way. Same idea again. And there's also a fire kasina, so that too can be taken as a meditation object and can become very refined as a consequence of that. He perceives air as air. Having perceived air as air, he conceives himself as air. He conceives himself as in air. He conceives himself apart from air. He conceives air to be mine. He delights in air. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So, same again. Air, one of the four elements, same idea as before. I'm not going to go into that anymore. I don't think it's, I think that's probably good enough. Yes. I think it's probably Abhidhamma in this case. Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah. He delights in. Okay. Yes. Yeah. He delights with reference to air. Yeah. Is it a form of delight? Yeah. Is it negative anti-delight? So, yeah. Okay. So that would be maybe when you have no choice because there is no happiness there. So you kind of the last resort, you delight in fame because of a sense of self. Yeah. Okay. Yes. So you delight in. In these things, rather, or reference to these things, rather than actually in them. Okay. Possibly. Usually, usually if you have reference in these simple things, usually you have the locative case. You know, it's unusual to have the accusative. Maybe in certain kind of favorite expressions, you might use the accusative, but it's not very common. You'd have to do a research project on how Abhinandati is used, whether it's kind of used with delight in or how exactly it works. So so I'm not sure. Yeah, but you can write up an essay if you like, Sylvester. No, okay. Yeah. There's so many essays to be written still, you know. There's a lot of potential out there for scholars and things. Okay, great. So, this is the problem. Sometimes there are people who know more about the suttas than you do, and then, of course, you have a. It's going to make life difficult. Sylvester is one of these people here. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. He perceives beings as beings. Having perceived beings as beings, he conceives beings. He conceives himself in beings, or among beings, perhaps. What is the. Pali here, yeah, no, it's okay, yeah, among beings is certainly possible, yeah. He conceives himself apart from beings, or maybe derived from beings. He conceives beings to be mine. He delights in beings. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So here again you have, he perceives beings, perhaps because of beings, yeah, is a possible translation of the ablative here. And again, here the idea is, of course, a being in this sense, refers presumably to the idea of something permanent. Yeah. So when you see a being, you are straight away seeing something permanent in there, something which is essential. And this is, of course, straight derived directly from your own sense of self. Yeah. So you see, because you have an idea of yourself, straight away, other beings also, you regard them as self straight away. Yeah? You just kind of, it's just a direct inference from your perception of yourself. So having perceived that, you conceive beings. So then you have ideas, you know, you make that perception kind of again stronger. You see beings in a certain way. Beings here, Buddha in Pali, can be very broad in meaning. It can really refer to any being. But in this particular case, it seems to mean mostly like human beings and perhaps animals or something like that. Perhaps other lower beings as well. That seems to be the main meaning in this particular case. So you conceive all of these beings, you have ideas of self about them, yeah? You conceive yourself among beings, you are just part of these beings, so this is how you have your own sense of self in relation to the others. You conceive yourself apart from beings, or perhaps here, better derived from beings, yeah? The other beings kind of give rise to you, like you have a mother and father or whatever, and then kind of you come because of that, yeah? So this could be maybe derivation here, possibly. Or it could be apart from beings in the sense that the sense of self, they are individual. So if someone else has a sense of self, then your sense of self is in relation to their sense of self. They are separate things. My sense of self is over here, your sense of self is over there. So there's many selves, many kind of inherent identities that exist. Yeah, so you identify in this way. And this is, of course, exactly what we do very often. Yeah, we identify our identity is often related to other people's identity. I am who I am because you are someone else. Yeah, and a lot of that also comes in, you know, when you look at the larger scale, things like nationalism, all these kind of things, comes from that. Yeah, we are Singaporean, or I am whatever, I don't know what I am anymore, but whatever you are, yeah, you have a certain nationality and you identify with that, and that is in contrast to other nationalities straight away, whatever that background might be. Families, class, all of these kind of things that we identify with, education, whatever it might be, these are the things that we identify with. And of course, you can see why that is problematic. Yeah? As soon as you have that sense of identity, you also have a problem with conflict, because you are different from someone else, and then they might they might cause harm to your sense of self or your sense of identity. Yeah, the Muslims are attacking the Buddhists, like in Myanmar, the Rohingyas are dangerous. So we got to defend ourselves against the Rohingyas before they become problematic and they damage Buddhist teachings. And this is where identity becomes difficult. Yeah, and why it is identity is a problem. And it always ends up leading to conflict one way or another. Yeah. So, for me, it is very obvious that if you, the way to actually support Buddhism in the long run, the way to actually make Buddhism work and not to destroy it, is not to kind of kill or to kind of, you know, sort out all the people you think are threatening it, but to practice it is really the way to ensure Buddhism survives in the future. That's really the only way. And then people will flock to the Buddhist teaching precisely because it is good, because it works, and not for some other, not by fighting other people. That's always going to be problematic. This is the conception of beings, and then we can just move on to the next one. How much time do we have, Eileen? How long do we normally go for? 2 hours. Okay, that's quite a bit of time then. Okay, good. Okay. You need an hour already. Yeah. But it goes faster and faster. The beginning is the hard part, so that's okay. He perceives gods gods because of gods, or gods as gods. Having perceived gods because of gods, he misconceives gods. Yeah, he conceives or misconceives himself in gods. Yeah, so if you're really conceited, you misconceive yourself as in gods. You misconceive yourself apart from gods. You misconceive gods to be mine. And you delight in gods. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So here you've probably already been reborn in the heavenly realm. Yeah, so you misconceive gods. Maybe you are a human being with special psychic powers. You see all these gods out there, and you conceive these individual identities called gods. And then you conceive yourself as among the gods. Devesu. Among the gods. So you are part of that group, yeah? So it gives you a sense of identity being part of that. Apart from gods. So here you might be a human being and you see the gods up there. So you are separate from the gods. And you conceive gods to be mine. That's interesting, yeah? The previous one was beings to be mine. You can sort of see how beings are yours. Yeah, perhaps you are, I don't know, you have some animals or whatever. This is my husband. Okay, that was okay. Or maybe in the time of the Buddha, you had slaves, yeah? So the slaves were yours. That would be beings be yours. The gods are yours. How does that work? Yeah, the gods are mine. Maybe if you are a very powerful god, so the lower gods are yours. Maybe that's how it works. The Pada Nimitta Vasavati versus the Nimitta Ratti, something like that. So the gods are yours. You want to control the gods. So you delight in the gods because they are yours, because you identify with in relation to the gods somehow. So you delight in the gods. As in the previous one, you delight in beings. Why is that? Because you haven't fully understood gods. You haven't fully understood that they are impermanent. You haven't fully understood that they are suffering. You haven't seen that they, you know, even there, you eventually, that identity is going to have to go. One day, impermanence is going to come and rip it away from you. And this is always the problem with identity. Whenever we identify with something, nature will come and one day pull the carpet from under our feet. And then you will wobble. And you will wobble, you will fall over, and you will hurt yourself. Why? Because you're attached to something that actually turned out not to be worthy of attachment. Something that didn't have any inherent essence. Something that had to change sooner or later. So even when you come to the gods, you have to be careful. There's a nice little passage in the Sakkapanya Sutta that I sometimes mention. There's a little passage, Sakkapanya. Sakya is the kind of the lord of the gods in the heaven of the 33, the Tavatimsa heaven. And Panya means questions. These are the questions of Sakya. Yeah? And Sakya comes down to the Buddha, and when he comes down, yeah, when the god comes down, this light, enormous light, yeah, descending, oh, this light comes down. And you can imagine the feeling, yeah, if you have this kind of light descending from heaven, coming down in front of you, very, very, very bright and brilliant. And straight away you become a Christian, yeah? Because you think, yeah, God is true, yeah, God is real. That's what you think, yeah. And so he comes down to the Buddha, and the Buddha is kind of pretty cool. He's very cool about it, yeah, whatever, Sakya, you know. And then Sakya asks him this question, the Buddha says to him, well, you ask this question, will you admit that you have asked the same question to other religious teachers before? And Sakya says, yes, I asked this, you know, of the Nigantha Nataputta, of the, what are they called, all the various, Makkali Gosala and all of these other people who were the kind of the big teachers at that particular time. And when I asked them, you know, instead of me being able to ask them, because they saw me coming down like this, they became my pupils instead, and they worshipped me. They worshipped me on the front. So this is the problem with gods. Once you have a god like that, someone who is very mighty and powerful, sometimes you really have to have your kind of, be really cool about it and say, well, actually, I'm seeing something pretty amazing, but does that mean that it is the creator god? Not necessarily. You just jump into conclusions. You're just seeing a bright light or something. You haven't actually seen anyone create the universe, yeah? So you kind of jump into conclusions there right away. And the Buddha, of course, precisely does not jump to conclusions. He inquires into what is going on. And I think a lot of people who say that they have, you know, sometimes you ask a Christian and they say, oh, I have a kind of experienced God. But when you actually inquire what they really have experienced, it is not so much that they have experienced a Christian God. What they often have experienced is something very special, something unique, something powerful, like love or compassion or unity or bright light, something very powerful. But to go from experiencing something powerful to saying that something is the creator of the universe, that's a big jump. Yeah, and that is kind of often where, from a Buddhist point of view, where the problem sometimes lies. So keep that keep that in mind is useful. But you can see how you can delight in these things. Okay, let's go on to the next one. He perceives Pajapati because of Pajapati. Having perceived Pajapati because of Pajapati, he conceives or misconceives Pajapati. He misconceives himself as in Pajapati. He misconceives himself apart from or derived from Pajapati. He misconceives him Pajapati to be mine. He delights in Pajapati. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood, I say. Pajapati means literally the Lord of creation. Paja is like the generation or the people, and Pati is Lord, so the Lord of creation. So this is actually one of the ways of saying the creator God according to Brahmanism. Pajapati was sometimes a word for the creator God. It's how the universe was created. Yeah. So remember now what I said at the beginning. The Buddha is talking to Brahmins. So Brahmins would often have the view that there is a creator God. Yeah. Pajapati has created the universe. So what he's doing here, he's kind of undermining the Brahmanical idea that there is a creator that created the universe. Pajapati, if there is such a thing as Pajapati, obviously there might be a God who is called Pajapati, but he wouldn't be the God in the Brahmanical sense of being a permanent essence that is always there. Yeah, or a creator of the universe. So here he is undermining this kind of Brahmin, what the Buddha would have called the Brahmin conceit. The conceit that there is something there that is superior and permanent in this particular sense. And in this case, I think the idea of to conceive yourself apart from very likely means conceive yourself as derived from Pajapati. Because if Pajapati is the creator of the universe, well, then everyone is derived from that. Yeah, we come from that. So you have this idea of being born like the creation, exactly, the creation of Prajapati's creation. So you conceive Prajapati, maybe you also conceive yourself here as identical with Prajapati, yeah? You conceive yourself as Prajapati, which means that this is also a very Brahmanical idea, the idea of the small self being equivalent to the large self, the Atman and the Brahman being the same thing here. Yeah, so when you die, you kind of go back to the primordial Brahmanical state. You conceive yourself as Pajapati, as part of that. As in Pajapati, you're like a subpart, perhaps, of Pajapati. You conceive yourself Pajapati to be mine. That's interesting. I wonder how that works. So that means that the Creator God is yours. You have control over the Creator God. So does that mean you created the Creator God? Is that what it means? Yeah. My God, nah, yeah. Is it my God? Okay, in that sense. Okay, yeah. I'm not sure. Usually it means, ownership in a more literal sense, usually. And anyway, possibly. Okay, thank you, Eileen, for an alternative interpretation. That's, that's good. We can add a few interpretations here. So I think one of the point here, we have four different ways in which you relate to a particular thing, four different ways in which you relate to Pajapati and everything else. I'm not sure if all four are actually meant to relate to every one of these topics. So, for example, with Earth, it is more likely that you regard Earth as mine, not so much that you identify directly with Earth. Here, I would say it's more likely that you identify directly with Pajapati, but not so likely that you regard Pajapati as mine. So there will be different one of these four that are more relevant in the particular cases. Yeah, but there's a kind of standard way of saying it all the way through. Okay, next one. He perceives Brahma. Because of Brahma, having perceived Brahma because of Brahma, he misconceives Brahma. He misconceives himself in Brahma. He misconceives himself apart from Brahma. He conceives Brahma to be mine. This is my Brahma. Stay away from my Brahma. Don't take my Brahma, or whatever it is. He delights in Brahma because of that, because he is not fully understood, it I say. So here we are very certainly on the Brahmanical kind of ground. Brahma is the Brahmanical god more than anything else. So here, Brahma, they consider Brahma often as, the creator of the universe. It's another word for the creator of the universe. And it is the Brahmanical God that would definitely be permanent from a Brahmin perspective. And here the Buddha is saying, no, forget about Brahma. Brahma too is, there is no such, you cannot conceive of Brahma in this particular way. You certainly cannot relate yourself or your own identity to Brahma in any of these ways. If you do, you're missing the point. So very similar to the previous one, because Brahma is also the creator God in this particular case. So of course, then you delight in Brahma, just like the previous one, you delight in Prajapati. If you consider yourself to be part of Brahma, you are Brahma. Obviously, you delight in that. Imagine if you have a very profound meditation experience. I know that some of you have had very good meditation experiences. When you have one of those experiences, it is very difficult not to identify with that, because it is so beautiful. So if you have a very powerful meditation experience, afterwards you come out and think, that was it. This was Brahma. This was kind of the absolute reality. This is the absolute truth. Okay. And then you start worshipping that or whatever. So it's very, very, very easy to fall into that trap, because there are such powerful experiences, unless someone points out to you, well, actually, maybe there's something more. And this is what the Buddha is saying here. Well, okay, fair enough, you have that experience, but let's see if it's possible to go beyond that. Maybe there's something more going on. And this is kind of what is so interesting about the Buddha. He's so radical in the way he approaches reality. He never takes anything for granted, never anything for given. You say that you have a certain experience. Okay, let's see if it's possible to go further. Let's see if there's anything beyond. Let's see if there's still some delusion left here. And this is what he's telling the Brahmins here. There's still an aspect of delusion left at this particular point. Okay. He perceives the gods of streaming radiance because of the gods of streaming radiance. So these are the Abhasaraha devas. So these are the kind of the equivalent to the second jhana realms. So now you kind of we're going up here, higher and higher up, and because you perhaps you had some experience with this or whatever, you know what these gods are all about because of the. Because you have been there or seen them or whatever. So having perceived that, you misconceive the gods of streaming radiance. You think they are permanent. You think they are real. They have a real essence to them. And you identify with that. You misconceive yourself as in or among those gods. You misconceive yourself as apart from those gods. Those gods may be real and I'm here apart from that somehow. And you misconceive the gods of streaming radiance to be mine. Whatever that means. And you delight in the gods of streaming radiance, Abhasara devas. Why is that? Because you have not fully understood it, I say. Then we have the same thing for the gods of refulgent glory. Refulgent glory. Sounds pretty amazing. So this is the Subhakinna gods. And the same thing again. I don't think we have to say go through the whole paragraph every time. After a while, this gets boring. So then you have the gods of great fruit. So you perceive the gods of great fruit as the Vehapala gods. And these are equivalent to the fourth jhana. The previous one, refulgent glory, equivalent to the third jhana. So these are all slightly different experiences. And each one of them, there's a tendency for us, because they are so powerful, the tendency to identify with that in one way or another. Especially in these cases, you tend to identify with it directly. I am that. This is me. I don't know if you heard of a book. There's a famous book in the Advaita Vedanta tradition called I Am That, written by one of these sages in the Advaita Vedanta tradition. Of course, this is precisely the sort of state that you would say, I am that about. But actually, the Buddha goes beyond that. The Buddha says, I am that is a delusion. It's the papancha. It is a palpitation, a proliferation, etc., etc. That's what the Buddha calls these things. So even I am that, even I am, has that same problem, according to the Buddha, one of the suttas in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Okay. He perceives the overlord, the Abhibhu, the one who has overcome. Yeah, same thing again. Abibu here is another word for Brahma. So we're kind of circling around the same area. So you have perceived the overlord because of the overlord. You conceive that overlord. You conceive himself as in that overlord. You're kind of a sub-aspect of it or a part. You're perhaps a derived aspect of the overlord again because the overlord is what gives birth to you. And this is what you find in the suttas. The Brahmins call themselves the ones who are born from Brahma. Yeah, same kind of thing here. You conceive the overlord to be mine. So the overlord is mine. Okay, so we are probably here, we're probably reaching the limits of conceit, I think, when the overlord is mine, the top highest kind of conceit. And you delight in the overlord because that identity with it in one way or another. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. This is, I would say, Abibu, overlord, usually is a reference to Brahma, usually. Yeah, I think the commentary says one thing, but I'm not sure if the commentary is right, because the idea of Abibu is often equated with Brahma in the sutta. It seems to have been what they used at that time as a word for Brahma. I think the commentary says it's like the unconscious, yeah, the asanyasatta, the beings without perception. But sometimes, you know, the problem is that the commentaries were often written in Sri Lanka 1,000 years after the Buddha, and often they didn't necessarily understand some of these Brahmanical terms, so it would depend. So it's an interesting way. The commentary may just want to fill in all the blanks to make sure everything is included, but that may not have been the Buddha's intention. The Buddha's intention may have been more to persuade the Brahmins that they were wrong in their theories, so I think it's perhaps more related to the Brahmanical outlook. Yeah. That's coming next. Yeah, coming up now. Yeah. Okay, so then we come to the four immaterial realms. Yeah, same thing again. It's pretty boring, isn't it? One exactly the same, again and again and again. Oh dear. Okay, anyway, we have started now, so we're going to have to continue. So he perceives the base of infinite space as the base of infinite space, or you can again say you perceive it because it exists, yeah, because of the base of infinite space. Having perceived the base of infinite space because of the base of infinite space, you misconceive that base, as yourself, as equivalent to yourself. Yeah, you become, this is what you are. You conceive yourself in that base as part of it, but it is more than just you. You conceive yourself apart from that, so you identify as separate somehow from this particular thing, or perhaps as derived from it. And then you conceive the base of infinite space to be mine. So you are more than that base, but you take ownership of it at the same time. And because all of this is related to yourself, you delight in that. Yay, base of infinite space, hooray, it is mine. Yeah, that's how you think, perhaps. Why is that? Because you have not fully understood it, I say. So the base of infinite space is like the plane of unlimited space. Yeah, it is one of those weird states of samadhi that you can get, which is all you have is a perception of no unlimited space. That's all you have, nothing else. It's unlimited space. Yeah. And then the next one is the plane of unlimited consciousness. Yeah, same thing again. They have same kind of relationship to it as the previous one. So you can imagine what that, I don't know if you can, maybe you can, imagine what it's like. Unlimited consciousness without limit in all directions. This consciousness, how is that different from unlimited space? Well, not sure, but it's obvious, it's supposed to be different. Then you have the same thing about nothingness. Yeah. Infinite space sounds a little bit like nothingness already, but now you get to nothingness, so that's not even that, yeah? So you have a conscious perception of nothingness. Yeah, so you identify with nothingness. I am nothingness, yay! And so this is the akinshayatana in the Pali, so identify with that. Of course, the point is that it may not sound all that interesting to be nothingness, but the of course, the point is that it is a very, very delightful perception. Yeah, you really tend to hang on to this thing, cling to this thing, because it's actually very beautiful. Huh? When you come to nothingness, even though there is nothing, it is incredibly peaceful and incredibly beautiful. The deeper you go into these samadhi experiences, the more powerful it is, and the more strongly often you will identify with them, because they are so, so powerful. Huh? Then we have the last one, which is the perception of the neither the base or the plane of neither perception or non-perception. And again, very hard to understand what that means. Yeah, the perception of neither perception or non-perception. It's, again, very obviously something very refined. And now you identify with that. So don't no need to worry too much about all of these things. The point is that the Buddha is trying to take away any possibility of attaching to anything. These are all the kind of perhaps terminology that was known in those days. Perhaps more has been added later on to kind of fulfill that, make that list complete perhaps. But the idea is to take away any chance of holding on to anything. This is kind of the point of this. So everything is shown to have the flaws of existence, of impermanent suffering and non-self. Okay, so now we are moving in a slightly different direction. And the next paragraph here goes as follows. He perceives the scene because of the scene. Having perceived the scene as the scene, he conceives himself as the scene. He misconceives himself in the scene. He misconceives himself apart from the scene. He misconceives the scene to be mine. He delights in the scene. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So what does this mean? How can you see a self in that which is seen? Because the scene seems to be something which is outside of us. Yeah, you see something, it's kind of outside of you. So how can that be yourself? And the reason why these things can be part of yourself is that even with sense consciousness, when you see something, the actual seeing is a mental thing. Yeah, when you see something, that the image that you have in your mind is apart from the external thing. It is also something that you have inside of yourself. So, for example, you can dream about things that you have seen. Yeah, it's a purely mental event. So you can actually, in this way, you can appropriate what you see externally to also be yours in terms of how you relate to it internally. They're not just external phenomena. The world is really, if you think about what the world really is, the world is experience. Yeah, we experience the world. We see the world in a certain way. And experience is always personal. I experience the world. I see it. I hear it. We'll see that in a second. And this way, you actually relate to this in an internal way because it's part of your experience of things. So in this sense, you can argue that you are the scene in the sense that you are the mental residue of that. Yeah, this is what I am. Your relationship to those things. You are... and then you have all the relationship again to this particular thing. You are that, or you are apart from it, or you are in it, or whatever, because of that. There's also an argument that you can actually have a self which is actually external to yourself as well. Apparently there are certain philosophies where you see the self as being an external thing, which is kind of strange from, I don't know, for me it sounds very, very strange. But apparently there are some religions or teachings that actually where they actually claim that the self is external. And this also would probably fit under this at the same time as well. So you delight in the scene, yeah? And this is kind of the thing here. And it could also be understood here, perhaps, as delighting, because you delight in the scene, that you actually delight in vision itself. Yeah, so if someone says that I'm going to make you blind, yeah, you say, no, thank you, usually, yeah? Not so interested in that, because why? Because you want to be able to see. We have a certain attachment to being able to see. If someone says you're going to go blind, usually you don't like that, yeah? So we get glasses so we can see properly and all these kind of things. So we have a quite a strong attachment to the five senses. And of course, that is one of the things that stops us from going deeper into meditation. We see them, at the very least, we see them as mine, something we want to control, something we want to be in charge of. We have the same thing for hearing or for the heard. So you perceive the heard as the heard. You can see yourself as apart from the heard, in the heard, and to the heard to be mine. And again, to be mine might be the most obvious one. And then, of course, then you delight in that. Another kind of sense perception here, because you have not fully understood it, I say here. Then we have the next one, which is perceived, the sensed as the sensed. And here the Pali for sensed is mutta. Mutta means, usually it means thought. And it is not entirely clear whether it should be translated as sensed or thought. Sensed is here a idea that is kind of thought out in the commentary. It is not really an idea from the sutta. So here it is possible that the right way of looking at this is actually as what has been thought. Yeah. So you perceive what is thought because there is thinking, because of the thought. Having perceived the thought because of thought, you conceive yourself as the thought. Yeah, or you conceive yourself as in the thought, or you conceive yourself as apart from, or maybe even derived from the thought, and you conceive the thought as mine, and you delight in the thought. Why is that? Because you have not fully understood it, I say. Yeah, and this is one of the very common things in among people, that you identify with your thinking, or you, at the very least, you are the thinker, you are in charge, these thoughts are mine. Yeah, but the more you kind of meditate, the more you start to doubt that. Because even if you don't want to think, you still think. You know what I mean? Yeah, you sit there, you don't want to think, okay, these thoughts still come. So how much are they yours? If they were yours, you'd have some control over them. But these blooming thoughts don't have any control over them. They come even unbid, they don't really want to have them. Still they come into your mind. So you start to kind of undermine a little bit of the thinking or the movement of the mind by understanding, seeing how they operate through your meditation practice. And the more you see that, the more you start to see that thinking is an entirely conditioned process. It happens because the conditions are in place, and you start thinking as a consequence. But yes, we tend to identify with this in a very strong way, of course. And the last one is even more powerful. Last one, you perceive the cognized because of the cognized. So vinyatang, this is kind of being conscious of things. So having perceived the cognized because of the cognized, you conceive yourself as the cognized. You are the cognizer. You are the knower. This is one of the deepest attachments or deepest sense of self that you can actually have. This is the idea that you are consciousness. You are awareness. Yeah, you are the knower of that which can be known in the world. So this is often a very direct identity. You identify as that. And this is the last thing to go usually during your meditation practice. Yeah, things kind of disappear gradually. The body disappears, the senses disappear. As you become more peaceful, the will starts to disappear. The mind becomes calmer and calmer, less and less things happening. But the knower is still there. The knower tends to still be left behind. And this is what this is really about here. Vinyatang, the knowing of the mental content, as opposed to knowing the content of the five senses, which the previous ones are about. So you conceive yourself in the cognized. Okay, so you're part of it, apart from the cognized. I don't know how that works, how you can be apart from the cognized. Usually cognized is kind of the root of most other things, maybe derived from the cognized, and the cognized as mine, and you delight in it because of all that identity business. Why is that? Because you have not fully understood it, I say. So this is one of those interesting things and very profound things about the Buddhist teachings, that even your awareness, yeah, even your consciousness, your ability to know anything at all, is actually impermanent, comes and goes, disappears and arises again. And this is what is so fascinating. And of course, this is very, very hard to grasp, precisely because it is so profound. You need some very, an extremely still mind to be able to see this, and how the consciousness moves from one sense to another one. Sometimes it even disappears completely, and then re-arises again, and then you can actually see these kind of things. So we're here dealing with some of the most profound teachings found in the suttas. Is this practical for anyone? Is this useful for you to know? Maybe, yeah. it's good to have a theoretical framework so you actually know what these teachings are about. You understand them overall, and this is what this is about. You really get some idea of non-self. But also, there are also some practical ways of using non-self, and I talked a bit about that earlier on this morning when I was talking about if you take the idea of non-self to its conclusion, it means that we are not really very responsible at all for how we live, and that a large part of it is just conditioned into us from the past. Yeah, this is one way of using it practically. But here we are looking at it from a slightly more theoretical perspective. Anyway, let's go on to the next one. He perceives unity as unity, or he perceives unity because of unity. Having perceived unity because of unity, he misconceives himself as that unity. He conceives himself in that unity, or apart from the unity. He conceives unity to be mine. He delights in unity. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. And this is an important one, because unity here is really another way of talking about samadhi. So far, we have really been talking about external phenomena, yeah, Brahma being an external phenomenon, and other phenomena which are outside of us. But here we're coming to things that we can experience ourselves in meditation practice. And at that time in India, there were many people who were very skilled meditators, who attained very deep states of samadhi. And you may remember the Buddha himself, before he became the Buddha to be, he would go to Udaka, Ramaputta, and Alara Kalama. You know that story, yeah? And he would practice under them, and he would attain very profound states of samadhi. And this would have been part of this thing called unity here. Ekatta is the Pali word. And so he's pointing out that even these very profound experiences, yes, you may experience unity. It means that your consciousness, everything is completely unified. It feels like the world is one. Yeah, it feels like everything is one. And if you misconceive that, you get to this idea like everything is one. We are all the same. We're all kind of part of the same consciousness or whatever. That is how you, it is very easy to misconceive and misconstrue this experience because they are so incredibly powerful. There's nothing outside of this. I'm completely unified. There's no movement of the mind. Yeah, there is no kind of sense of self. It's almost completely gone. Actually, it is basically gone because all that's left is consciousness. Only afterwards, when you come out, you can take that as a self later on. But really, the sense of self is no longer there, because the sense of self is very often has to do with the doer, yeah, the agent in our life. And if you're not no longer, if the agent is gone, there's no sense of you being there anymore. So these are extraordinarily powerful experiences, and that is why the Buddha here is taking this separately. This is what samadhi really is about. Okay, so you most likely here is that you identify with the samadhi directly, so you conceive yourself as that unity. Yeah? It is yours, your unity. Yeah? The next one is you perceive diversity because of diversity. And because you perceive that, you misconceive yourself as diversity. Yeah? You misconceive yourself in diversity, or apart from diversity, or diversity to be yours, to be mine. He delights in diversity. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So here is this is like a very different philosophical position, where you identify with the diversity of things. So perhaps this is some kind of a philosophical position whereby you take a range of different phenomena together to be you, or to be a self. I'm not really sure if I fully understand what this is supposed to mean, but it is quite possible, very likely a philosophical position that people use. If you have someone taking unity as a self, you can guarantee someone will come along and say, take the exact opposite position. Yeah, that's how humanity works. And especially especially in India, in those days, the Indians were very famous for arguing with each other. Yeah, or they would love a good argument, and they would kind of, there's classical examples in the suttas about how the debates would go, and say, yeah, you have been refuted, save your doctrine if you can. And they would kind of argue with each other in this way. It's quite funny when you read, look at that. Probably wouldn't be so funny to be in the debate, but it's fun to read about it afterwards. Somehow, then, you relate yourself to this diversity. Yeah, I don't exactly know what to say about that. So let's go on to the next one. He perceives all as all. Having perceived all as all, he misconceives himself as all, as everything. Yeah, he conceives himself in all. He conceives himself apart from all. He conceives all to be mine. He delights in all. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So here, this is a philosophical position whereby you consider everything just to be part and parcel, be kind of all belong together in one thing. Yeah, the all, everything is just part of some larger thing. And this is also part of, I think, some of the ancient Indian philosophies that still exist today. The idea that the kind of the multitude or the diversity that we see in the world are rooted in one single thing. And it's just like a multitude of illusions that come back to one thing, really. So you see the all, you see the all because of all of these things, and then you have a philosophical position about it, and then you have a relationship between your supposed identity and that philosophical position. So you can see how it gets quite complicated after a while. And then you have the relationship, either you identify with that all, you are in it, you are apart from it, or whatever, it's yours. And of course, straight away, you then delight in that, because it is yourself, after all, that it's all about, because about yourself, you have to delight in that. Why do you do all that messing around? Because you haven't understood it, says the Buddha. And then the last one, and this is an interesting one, because this is becoming closer home to Buddhist ideas again. And you perceive Nibbana because of Nibbana. Having perceived Nibbana as Nibbana, you conceive himself as Nibbana. You conceive himself in Nibbana. You conceive yourself apart from Nibbana. You conceive Nibbana to be mine. He delights in Nibbana. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So it is not entirely clear what is meant by Nibbana in this particular context. But the way that I would like to interpret it, at least for now, is that here it means people's ideas about Nibbana. Yeah, when you perceive, if you are a worldling, and you are a putujana, an ordinary person, you don't really know what Nibbana is. So whenever you think about Nibbana, you perceive it's guaranteed to be wrong. So it's really just your idea of Nibbana. It's completely misconstrued, very likely. So you have some idea about something. And because of that, you then start thinking about it, you misconceive it even further, and you identify with that Nibbana. This Nibbana is mine. And this is actually, this is more important than what you might think. And the reason why this is important is because the idea of misconceiving Nibbana in this way is actually very common, even in the present day. We give Nibbana some content that it doesn't actually have. We give it an identity or an aspect of permanence or something like that, which actually it doesn't really have. It's a very common thing these days to what is called the sāsatadi. The sāsatadi means like the eternalist view. And it's very common to project that eternalist view onto Nibbana itself. And so people see Nibbana as an internal thing. Yeah, I will go to Nibbana and I'll hang out in Nibbana forever after. Yeah. What's the difference between that and God? Or what's the difference between that and Brahma? There isn't really any difference anymore because you are identifying Nibbana in the wrong way. You have a deep samadhi experience. One of the interesting things that often happens is that people get, there's often this arguments about what the jhanas are. I don't know if you've seen those arguments. They're very common on the certain internet forums. They're arguing about the true meaning of jhana. And some people say, jhana is easy to get. Yeah, you're thinking and the body is there and you kind of have a bit of joy and you have the first jhana. Other people say jhana is really profound. Yeah, you have to go into very profound deep state of samadhi. So who is right? Now, it's sometimes very hard to know who is right unless you have someone who has some experience with these things who can kind of guide you in these matters. It's actually very difficult to sort out sometimes. And sometimes I feel sorry for people having to endure these discussions, so I probably recommend you to stay out of them altogether here. But there is a problem there, yeah, because the jhanas, if you get the jhana experiences wrong, if you misunderstand what they are, then it is very likely that when you do get eventually a really deep samadhi experience, you're going to think that is nibbana, because nibbana comes after the jhanas. Yeah? So if you get it wrong, you tend to get everything wrong, and actually you destroy the whole path of Buddhism as a consequence. So this is what the Buddha, in a sense, is saying here, I think is saying here, be careful about how you think about nibbana. It is not really meant to be a place where you're going. It's not something you're supposed to identify with. You can't identify with nibbana. And I think this is one of the dangers of using the word nibbana in the suttas and not translating it. Yeah, when you use the word nibbana, you can almost put anything. You can project any kind of ideas into it. Yeah, oh, nibbana, yeah, sounds really nice, yeah. But actually, if you translate it, the real meaning of nibbana is extinguishment. Yeah, and if you think about it as extinguishment, it's something that is quite much more difficult to project anything into, because extinguishment is like a negative term. It doesn't have any positive existence. It is just something which is gone. Yeah, and because something which is gone is much more difficult to kind of think of it as something eternal. It's maybe eternally gone, but still isn't really something that you can hold on to in the same way. So that is why it is. I think it's very good to translate these terms, because the ancient Indians, when they heard the word nibbana, they would have known, well, actually it means extinguishment. That's what they would have heard. Whereas we hear nibbana, yeah, that's good, yeah, I want to go to nibbana. That's what we hear, because we don't really have a feeling for what the word actually means. That's the difference there. So, again, you conceive, you misconceive yourself as nibbana, yeah, you identify with it, obviously you haven't understood what it is. You are in nibbana, you're somehow part of this. You are apart from nibbana, I wouldn't recommend that, that's even worse, yeah. And you see nibbana as mine, that's my nibbana, stay away, don't touch my nibbana. And of course, in all of these cases, you... you delight in it, because you are actually, you are attaching to it some way, one way or another. Okay. So there you are. These are the various ways that the Buddha talks about this view of the self. Yeah, the various ways it can arise. Some of these overlapping, some of them, I'm not even sure if it is a complete map, but at least there is a lot in there. So... what do you think? Good or bad? Who knows, perhaps? Good lad, who knows? Yeah. So, yeah, okay. Let us continue, and let's just do the last part very quickly. I'm not going to do this very long, because it is actually fairly, it is not perhaps straightforward, but it is not that much to add to what we have seen so far here. So the next one here is for the disciple in the higher training. So this is the Arya, the noble ones, and the noble ones are not including the Arahants in this case, but those who are still striving for Arahantship, but the ones who have an insight into the teaching. Yeah, and because they have an insight, this is how they are explained. Bhikkhus, a bhikkhu who is in the higher training, whose mind has not yet reached the goal, and who is still aspiring to the supreme security from bondage, he directly knows earth because of earth, or as earth. So you can see the difference here. In the previous one, it said perceives earth as earth. Here he says directly knows earth as earth. And this is the thing about the stream entry. Once you become a stream entry, you have seen reality. Yeah, this is what stream entry is. You have seen the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, what the Buddha taught us. So this is why here it says you directly know these things. And directly knows means that you don't have a misperception of it anymore. You don't have the view that there is something which is inherently mine in this. It is not inherently happy. It is not permanent. It's not beautiful. It has the exact opposite attributes. the problem for the stream entry is that the stream entry, even though they have this view hasn't kind of sunk into their mind 100%. So the stream entry still has some work to do to also rectify their thoughts and their perceptions. Yeah, and this is kind of the difference here. So the stream entry, even though they have the view, they know this, still sometimes they think wrongly or they perceive wrongly because of the old habits. But if you ask them, if you go, okay, listen, stream entry, yeah, have you ever done that before? Listen, stream entry, you know, what is your view about Earth? And they will, oh yeah, Earth, yeah, that's impermanent. They will know that. But still, they might think about it occasionally. Yeah. So this is the problem here. So this is what comes up next then. Having directly known Earth as Earth, he should not conceive, or they should not conceive themselves as Earth, or should not conceive themselves in Earth, should not conceive themselves as apart from Earth, should not conceive themselves as Earth to be mine. He should not delight in Earth. Why is that? Because they must fully understand it, I say. Yeah, so there is this work to be done by the stream enter. They have penetrated, they have got the right view, but now they have to align all the other mental faculties, the perception, the thoughts, everything has to be aligned with that view. Still, there's a residue left in the mind which misunderstands. And to understand this, there is a nice sutta in the called the Kemaka Sutta in the Kanda Sanghuta. And there's a monk called Kemaka, and he... is it him? Yeah, I think it is him. And he explains the distinction here between the stream mentor and the arahant. Because all of these monks, they think he is an arahant because he says, I have understood this. And he says, no, I haven't, because I'm just a stream mentor or an anagami or whatever it is. And then he says, it's just like when you have washed your clothes. After you have washed your clothes, they can still smell a little bit of washing powder. In those days, they used cow dung as for washing. Kind of nice, isn't it? Is it cow dung for washing? Yeah? I think cow dung is supposed to somehow sterilize. It has a kind of sterilizing effect. So they use cow dung in those days. For what these days, we wouldn't think that is such a good idea. But in those days, they use cow dung. Yeah. And so they still smelt of cow dung afterwards. So then when you finish with the washing, you would put the clothes in a scented casket, a casket which is perfumed. Yeah. And then after a while, the cow dung disappears and the clothes smell okay again. So the stream enter is like the one who has washed his clothes. It's a little bit of cow dung smell, yeah? So for the cow dung smell to disappear, you just have to wait for a while. You have to keep on contemplating for this. And one day, the cow dung is completely gone, yeah? And just perfume behind it. And then you know you're an arahant as a consequence. So that is... That is the simile. It's actually right there in the sutta. It's kind of nice. And it's interesting, isn't it? Sometimes you read these things just because it's also interesting to read about India, read about a different culture 2,500 years ago, and to see the contrast. Yeah, it's kind of it's also fascinating in a sense. Anyway, so then you have not only do you know Earth, but the stream mentor knows everything, all of the things that we have seen above. Yeah, water all the way down for the. Through the all as the all and the Brahma realms and the immaterial realms and the seen and the heard and the cognized or whatever, all that is part for the stream mentor. All of that the stream mentor has known. And last of all, he has known or she has known Nibbana as Nibbana. Having directly known that, they don't misconceive Nibbana as being somehow related to their self. Nibbana means extinguishment, and it doesn't mean nothing you can appropriate or attach to in Nibbana, because it is just the ending of things, the ending of the defilements primarily, but also ending, ultimately an ending of experience at the very end of it. Why is that? Because this person must fully understand it, I say. Yes. Yeah, like in between. Yeah, I think they are like very obviously very close to this kind of realization. Yeah, they're almost there, but they haven't really fully attained it yet. So it must be kind of a stage where you almost know that this is going to happen, and then you are kind of just almost like waiting for it to happen. But this interest, they must be very close, because one of the things about them is that you know that you have to become a stream mentor in the same lifetime. Yeah. So I think it says somewhere in one of the suttas, it says that a sadhanusari, dhammanusari can never take any sankhara as self or as permanent or as happiness. So they know that no particular sankhara can be taken that way, but they seem to haven't yet taken the inferential leap to understand everything actually is like that. So if you ask about a specific thing, they will know, but they haven't really made the leap to know that everything actually is in this way here. So they're very, very close. Yeah. Okay, so let us look at the arahanta. Bhikkhu who is an arahant, retains destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached his own goal, destroyed the fetters of being, is completely liberated through final knowledge. They too directly know earth because of earth. Having directly known earth as earth, they do not misconceive themselves as earth, nor do they misconceive themselves in earth, nor do they misconceive themselves apart from earth. They do not misconceive earth to be mine. He does not delight in earth. Why is that? Because he has fully understood it, I say. So this is the arahant, yeah. No more delight. No more craving, no more desire for any of these things. And here, of course, it is the earth itself. You have no craving for the earth. But actually, the whole point, of course, here is that if you go through a whole list, the arahant has no craving for any of these things. That is what kind of makes the arahant so unique. No craving for any of these things, including the highest happiness that is available in samsaric existence. All of that is gone. Arahant doesn't even crave for nibbana, and that's why the arahant does not commit suicide. Yeah, otherwise you might commit suicide straight away because you found kind of the highest happiness, but don't even have craving for that. You just live on until they die, and then they kind of pass on into the supreme extinguishment when they pass away. So this is the person who has done what they had to be done, lay down the burden. Yeah, these are kind of very nice little descriptions of the arahant. Lay down the burden. The rest of us, we're still carrying the burden. Yeah. Yeah, does not conceive. The other one is should not conceive. This one is does not conceive. Yeah, that's the difference. So one is still practicing. The other one is finished. Yeah. Yeah. So lay down the burden. What does that mean? What is the burden? You know what the burden is? Five khandhas, yeah? It is the sutta called the burden in the Sangyutta Nikaya. The five khandhas. So basically, this is the burden right here. Yeah, burden. So this, you have laid down the burden. No more attachment to it. So this is what the arahant is. You're liberated through final knowledge. The rest of us, we are still imprisoned. We're not liberated. The prison of samsara. This is what the arahant is like. And this is what the arahant is like. There's no more attachment to any of these things. You don't see any self in any of these things. And this is what the arahant then has given up. Because you have fully understood it. You have fully understood it. Not only have you got the right view, but now you have also aligned your perceptions and thinking and everything else in accordance with that view. So your cognitive apparatus or your cognitive abilities are now perfectly aligned with reality. There's no more distortion there. No more misconceiving of reality at all there. And then that is true also for all the other ones. Why? Because they have fully understood it, I say. And then there is a couple of more paragraphs on the arahant, and they are almost exactly the same. The only difference is that there is a difference here in the Buddha says, why is that? And the next one it says, because they are free from lust, raga. Yeah, and then it's because they're free from hate, dosa, and because they're free from delusion. Moha is the last one. But basically, it's exactly the same thing, just different ways of looking at the arahant from different perspectives. Then you have at the very end, coming to the end of the sutta now, we have the Tathagata, who is the Buddha. And the question now is the Buddha any different from the arahant? And so here is what the Buddha has to say about the Buddha. Because the Tathagata too, accomplished and fully enlightened, directly knows earth because of earth. Having directly known that, he does not misconceive himself as earth. He does not misconceive himself as in earth. He does not conceive himself apart from earth. He does not conceive earth to be mine. He does not delight in earth. Why is that? Because the Tathagata has fully understood it to the end, I say. So does that mean that the Tathagata has any deeper understanding than the other arahants? The answer to that is that the understanding, the level, is the same. The Buddha says elsewhere that the arahant has the same kind of insight level as the Buddha. But it may be that the Buddha has a kind of a broader, and the depth of understanding is the same, but that the Buddha maybe has investigated a bit further. So his overall ability to express it and talk about it and whatever may be better than the ordinary arahant. But essentially, the only difference between the arahant and the Buddha is that the Buddha walked the path first, and then he was able to pass it on to others. And I remember many years ago, I said that to someone, and they said, "What? How can you say that? The Buddha was better than, surely better than the arahant. Yeah, how can you say it was the same? That's terrible. You know, bad karma, whatever." This person was very attached to the idea that the Buddha is something different from the... And I think maybe because probably that person had a little bit of Mahayana leanings, and that is more common, perhaps, in Mahayana circles. But according to early Buddhism, actually, no, arahant and the Buddha is basically the same. But remember that if someone is able to find the path on their own, that already is magnificent and is quite astonishing. Most of us, we try to follow along this path, we still can't do it. The Buddha, to be, actually did it on their own without any help from anyone else. Well, they had help up to a certain level, of course, but beyond that, they had to discover it by themselves. And that is really the special genius of the Buddha, this ability to find the path without a guide. That is kind of the astonishing thing here. And that is where the Buddha makes the Buddha unique. And that already is, of course, worthy of enormous amount of respect. Okay, and then we have the very last paragraph. Because the Tathagata too, accomplished and fully awakened, directly knows earth because of earth. Having directly known earth as earth, he does not misconceive himself as earth. He does not misconceive himself as in earth. Does not misconceive himself apart from earth. He does not misconceive earth to be mine. He does not delight in earth. Why is that? Because he has understood that delight is the root of suffering. Yeah, and that that with being as condition, there is birth, and that for whatever has come to be, there is aging and death. Therefore, bhikkhus, through the complete destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishment of craving, the Tathagata has awakened to the supreme full awakening, I say. So this last little paragraph here is actually quite interesting, because here the Buddha draws in dependent origination into this sutta as well, just to make sure that we kind of get everything in one sutta. And so why is it that the Buddha has given up all of this idea, all of this? Because he has understood that delight is the root of suffering. Yeah, delight here, the way it is used here, is a synonym for craving. Craving is the root of suffering. Why is craving the root of suffering? Well, because craving is the thing that drives you on in samsaric existence. And if you want to if you want to continue on in samsaric existence, doing the same thing again and again and again and again, and again and again and again and again, and again and again, yeah, then of course, this after a while, it gets kind of tedious. And this is not tedious, it gets downright terrible, downright awful. And so the Buddha says, it's the root of suffering, because it is the root of suffering. Of course, once you see that, it's like you have a hot coal in your hand. What are you going to do? Are you going to think, yeah, should I throw it out or should I kind of keep it? You kind of chuck it out straight away. And this is kind of the point. When you see suffering fully, the idea with seeing suffering is that you turn away from all of those things that are painful. You go in a different direction. You can't crave for what is suffering. And that's why it is impossible for an arahant and a Buddha to crave. Because all that can be craved in the world is just more suffering. This is the insight of the Buddha. And this is what is so radical. Yeah, craving is always a craving for things that are suffering. Yeah? And this is really the teaching of the Buddha. Panchakanda, Panchapadana Kanda Dukkha Sankitena, yeah, or Sankitena goes first or whatever. And in brief, the five khandhas are suffering here. Yeah? The five khandhas subject to attachment are suffering here. Yeah? Yeah, regardless. And therefore, craving does not make any sense anymore. And then he says, with that with being as condition, and let me just get the Pali here. Bhava, yeah, so bhava being or existence, with existence as condition, there is birth. So here we are seeing the problem that once there is existence, yeah, suffering, once you exist in a certain way, and that includes the delight is what in a sense makes you exist, because when you delight in things, your mind is set on certain things in this life. You attach to certain things, you hold on to certain things. It means you have certain mental preoccupations, and those mental preoccupations is your mental existence. Yeah, you exist on a certain level in a sense, and that then drives you on to a certain rebirth in the future. Huh? So rebirth depends on how you exist now. If you exist in a very bright and light way, you actually get reborn in a parallel way in the future. Huh? And with for whatever has come to be, this is then the idea of being reborn. There is old age and death. Yeah, it ends up with old age and death, which is really a shorthand for suffering here. It says aging, but really old age is the correct translation here. So it ends up with old age and death. And this is already very fascinating. You know, we talk about dukkha being the problem in life, but one of the things that actually drove the Buddha to become the Buddha, one of the things that started him out on the Buddhist, on the path towards awakening, was actually old age and death. If you read the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, the Noble Search Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya number 26, the Buddha's main reflection that got him started on the spiritual practice was the fact that he was going to get old and die. This was how he understood suffering at that particular time. Yeah, and he realizes, he actually talks about this in great detail. Why, if I'm going to die, why should I go around attaching to all of these other things in life that are also going to die? What are those other things? Other people. Yeah, wife and children, other people, possessions, etc., etc. I'm already have enough problems of my own. I'm going to pass away. I'm attached to all of these other things. They're also going to die. I'm asking for suffering in the future. So old age and death was the thing that really drove the Buddha to understand what suffering was about. So it's a very powerful contemplation, very powerful reflection. And here also, suffering, the whole path, the whole problem, ends up with old age and death. Birth must always lead to old age and death. For that reason, it's always going to be suffering. It's always going to be problematic. Simple things, old age and death. Who would have thought that old age and death had such profound consequences? That actually it started the Buddha out on the Buddhist path. He practiced, made him awakened, and then he taught. And we are still following this teaching today, 2,500 years ago. Why? Because one man thought about aging and death in a very profound way. That's why we're here. It's kind of astonishing, isn't it? So, therefore, bhikkhus, through the complete destruction, the word is kaya, which means like ending, complete ending, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishment of craving, the Tathagata has awakened to the full supreme enlightenment or awakening, I say here. And then exactly the same with all the other ones, all the way down to Nibbana, and he doesn't hold on to any of this. This is what the Blessed One said, but those bhikkhus did not delight in the Blessed One's words. Okay, so the very last one there, which is kind of interesting, did not delight. Every other sutta in the Pali Canon ends with they delighted, yeah, but not in this one. Why is that? And the reason for that, according to the commentary, and it kind of makes sense, is that these Brahmins had their entire doctrine and teaching overturned. Yeah, what happened to my God Brahma? What happened to myself? Yeah, it's all gone now. According to the Buddha, it doesn't exist at all. And of course, because it was all overturned and now they felt really deflated and kind of their conceit was gone and whatever, they were not happy after that. But it had a good ending. Yeah, because later on, according to another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, they were taught again. And when they were taught again later on, they all became enlightened. So it was just the kind of, you know, initial shock of the reality of the Buddhist teaching. And later on, it kind of went in the right direction. So good ending, like a Hollywood movie. Yeah. So, so there you are. Okay. I'm impressed just that awake. That's really good news. That's great. Well done. So, any last comments, questions, complaints?
Thanks, Bhante. Thank you, Bhante. Do you think there's a chance you could have a chat with Bhikkhu Bodhi about how he translates? Because this thing is addressed to Brahmins,
yeah.
So there's a lot of evidence that at least two of the passages here need to be understood in the context of how the pre-Buddhists understood them. So, for example, the four paragraphs dealing with the seen, heard, sensed, and cognized is a motif that occurs over and over and over again in the Upanishads, where the Brahmins and even the Kshatriyas, they actually use an earlier model to the five aggregates. And that earlier model was the seen, heard, sense, and cognize, and they treated those things as giving rise, as being the self.
Yeah.
And then the other one is Sabang.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I think it should be translated with a capital A.
Capital S?
Capital A. Not small all as in everything, but the meaning of Sabang or Sarvang to the Upanishad thinkers was that which was complete and full.
Okay.
In fact, in the Upanishads, you actually see passages saying that Brahman strives to become Sabang.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Because there's actually a short little sutta in the Nidana Samyutta, which talks about the older cosmology and the younger cosmology, Sabang Ati and Sabang Nati.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So exactly. That's the that's actually in the Kashanagota Sutta. And probably in okay. Yes, I think that's a good point. And I think that there's many things in this sutta which kind of points in that direction. Also the Prajapati being in there and some of those things. So I think it's probably very likely. This is one of the things that Richard Gombrich was always talking about, a very significant, important, not only him, many others as well, to always understand the suttas in the intellectual context that actually, you know, which would be the context in ancient India is a very important point. And in these cases, you should know your Upanishads a little bit, probably know a little bit about the Vedas as well, but certainly the Upanishads, to be able to understand how these things actually come about. Because it's not very obvious, you know. For example, you say the seen and the heard were kind of ways that they would look upon the self, you know, that they would actually see a self in these things. It's not very obvious why that is the case unless you understand it in that particular context. Because here it is quite kind of cryptic. How can the seen be a self? It's not actually very, very obvious as such. But I think there are actually many places in the suttas where sambang is used as full and complete in that particular sense rather than as the all, and actually has that meaning of full and complete. So it is certainly a tested way of using it also in the suttas themselves. Yeah. Well, thanks, Sylvester. So that's good. Yeah. So next time we should have a course on the Upanishads. I think that's a good idea. you can teach that, Sylvester. You want to have it? This would be a good idea. Go any further. Okay. Is there any other questions about any of this? Or have you all had plenty enough already? There are still a few left, Amber. That's really really amazing. So anything else? Anyone want to say anything here? Yeah? Everyone? Yeah.
Can I just know why do you say OH and aging? I thought that aging is actually also suffering.
Aging is suffering. I'm saying that because the way it is defined in the sutta, as it was defined in the way that means old age. It is defined as kind of, you know, your hair becoming gray, your teeth kind of breaking up, and you kind of get, you know, you're kind of bent over like a roof bracket, all these kind of things. It's always defined as old age, not as aging. I think the reason why it is translated as aging is, I think it was done by Nanamoli originally. I think the reason is because not everyone becomes old. Yeah. So because not everyone becomes old, it uses age, because everyone ages, obviously. Yeah? So that is kind of more acceptable from a completeness perspective. But I think actually it is wrong here. And this was another thing I actually pointed out to Bhikkhu Bodhi. We shouldn't translate it as aging. And he said, well, he had just inherited the term from Venerable Nanamoli, who was the previous translator of this particular sutta. So if you look at the Anguttara Nikaya translation, it's translated as old age. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
No more questions. We shall end there. Or last one. Last shot.
I have one question. It says that when you perceive something as it is, it's not as good. But if you know it as it is, it's better. But how do you perceive something and how do you know something? Because to me, if I see something, it's a cup to me. Am I perceiving it or am I knowing it as a cup?
You're perceiving it probably. Yeah? I don't know, but I assume that you're perceiving it. But whether you're seeing a cup or not is kind of irrelevant, because cups are just cups. They don't really kind of matter all that much. What matters is how you relate to your body and mind. That's what really matters. That's the most important thing. But perception is always distorted until you have the knowledge, until you have a deep insight. It's only with a deep insight that you actually know things as they actually are. Yeah, and that insight depends on samadhi. Samadhi pachaya yata buddha nanadasana. So you have to, actually it doesn't say that, it says upanisa. But anyway, you have to, you need that samadhi, you need a deep meditation to actually be able to see things according to reality. Yeah? That's what it's knowing things means seeing them according to reality, in a deep sense. Yeah, and whether you see a cup according to reality is kind of irrelevant. It really refers back to your body and mind. That's what it refers to. That is the content of the insight or wisdom meditation, ultimately. Yeah. So normally in ordinary life, perception is always going to be distorted. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn. So sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's pay respects.